Well, it's now my sincere privilege and pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Eckel, who is professor of medicine, physiology, and biophysics, as well as professor of pharmacy at the University of Colorado at Denver. He has a named chair in atherosclerosis, and 2 years ago, he was chair of the American Heart Association. Dr. Eckel is going to discuss cardiovascular disease prevention and lifestyle. Now, when I looked at his CV and all that he has accomplished, I really expected a crotchety old decrepit man, sort of bent over. But looking at this young, robust individual, I realize that he is clearly walking the talk. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Eckel.
Thank you very much, Robert. It's really a pleasure to be here. Rich Robbins and I kind of hung out together about 20 years ago. Rich, wasn't that right? Back at the University of Colorado. And some of us stayed, some of us left, and you've left and now kind of headed back west. But Houston's not Denver, and I won't go into that any further, okay? So I'm not Michael DeBakey, and I'm not Dr. Noon either. So I'm Bob Eckel, kind of just a practical guy who thinks about things that relate to day-to-day life. And so I'm an endocrinologist, and to become president of the American Heart Association is a misfit, isn't it? Why would the American Heart Association want to make an endocrinologist their president? Well, I'm not quite sure still, and it's history at this point in time, but I got active in the AHA with the Nutrition Committee in the mid-late 90s because my research is in obesity. I really work both with human subjects in obesity research, and I create transgenic and knockout models to try to modify energy partitioning in ways that we can keep people thin once they've lost weight. So my obesity interest, I think, initially was why they asked me to come on board and share some of my thoughts. And that kind of built into a new scientific council at the AHA, the Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Metabolism Council, which deals with not only obesity, but diabetes and physical activity and nutrition. And then from there, ultimately, the path towards the presidency. And I had no goal and no desire. I thought they were asking the guy next to me when they asked if I'd be willing to be nominated. I really couldn't believe they actually wanted me to be president of an organization, a cardiologist. But I must admit, the cardiologists were very hospitable. And I think what it does say is that metabolic diseases today are so important to cardiovascular disease that at least for a year they could tolerate an outsider who didn't maybe speak their language and recognized, I think, that this is an important area. So it could have been many people other than myself, but it was a privilege and I really enjoyed my time there. So what I thought I'd do, this is a general audience, and I thought Peter Libby is a good colleague and friend at the Brigham and Women's, and Peter has a great movie that I used to show routinely about 7 or 8 years ago with general talks about atherosclerosis, because what we're going to see what follows is a whole sequence of support and evidence to indicate that your lifestyle is really relevant to cardiovascular disease. So, you know, Peter's movie is a bit dated, to be honest with you. The whole science of atherosclerosis hadn't changed very much. So it's kind of a neat springboard into what's going to follow. So let's take a few minutes and look at this movie, and we'll go from there.
Of course, the heart is the innocent bystander in most cardiovascular diseases, and we're concerned about the blood vessel. Atherogenesis begins when there are risk factors, such as hyperlipoproteinemia, here depicted by the yellow particles, which can accumulate in the intima, where they set up an inflammatory process that can eventually call in inflammatory cells such as blood monocytes, the precursors of the lesional macrophages. There is one now engulfing lipid. Let's take a look closer up at what happens to recruit these leukocytes, which ordinarily roll along the endothelium. When the endothelium is inflamed, the endothelial cell will express receptors that engage counter ligands on the leukocyte, allowing for a firm attachment, and then chemotactic inflammatory mediators will cause the monocyte to enter the wall, where again it will engulf modified lipoprotein particles, shown here by the brown color of some of these particles, and become foam cells. Meanwhile, smooth muscle cells that are resident in the intima may begin to divide and form a fibrous cap. There will also be other smooth muscle cells in the media that will crawl into the blood, contributing to the transition from a purely fatty lesion to one that has a more fibrous character. Now, if you have continued hyperlipoproteinemia, you will have growth of that lipid core, as depicted here, with the remodeling outward that you saw so nicely defined by Steve Nissen, And you'll have ongoing inflammation, which will provide a stimulus for the lymphocytes to send signals to the macrophage bone cell to secrete that all-important proteolytic enzyme that can break down the collagen in the plaque's lipid core and eventually weaken the plaque to such a degree the vibration, as Dr. Pfuster says, can lead to rupture and occlusive thrombus, which in many cases will cause acute myocardial infarction. And of course, not all plaque ruptures will lead to an occlusive and sustained thrombus. In many cases, we believe that the plaque rupture may lead to a more limited kind of neural thrombosis, which may cause an episode of unstable angina, but which then will become resorbed and heal, stimulate through platelet products the fibrosis of the fibrous cap, and eventually lead to growth of the plaque and the formation of a more complicated fibrous lesion. Now, when we intervene with our contemporary lipid-lowering therapy, I believe that the experiments that I've shared with you have shown that we can shrink the lipid core, you've seen this in Steve's data as well, cause loss of the macrophages, including their death, and allow the smooth muscle cells to reinforce that fibrous cap, rendering the plaque one which would be much more stable.
All right. Now, the science of atherosclerosis really, I think, has evolved very little, and that's not a criticism of the science. It's simply that the concept of inflammation, lipid and lipoproteins, and other risk factors contributing to the process is clearly well substantiated. I think one thing that's going on now, Val Fuster's lab in New York really is responsible in part for this, is those mononuclear cells may not arise entirely from the circulation, but actually may move from the fat layer, the adventitia, directly through the media and be part of the pathologic process of atherosclerosis. So the whole idea is obesity is really a very important issue in terms of cardiovascular disease risk, but maybe it's how much fat you get around your arteries, your big arteries, that may also contribute to that risk. Now, my talk is really going to kind of be based on a paper that was published in all three professional journals of the American Cancer Society, the American Diabetes Association, and the American Heart Association in 2004. And that paper was entitled Preventing Cancer, Cardiovascular Disease, and Diabetes. And just parenthetically, the prevention of all these diseases is quite similar in terms of a healthy lifestyle. So let's take a look at what that document said. It said, first of all, and this is highly evidence-based, don't smoke. It's an obvious statement, and we all recognize the importance of that. The second is screen for early detection of disease. The third is improving nutrition, and here we're talking about not only quantity, but quality of the diet. And the fourth issue is physical activity. What I'd like to do now is progress systematically through these, spending much of my time on the last two, but giving a bit of information on tobacco and very limited attention to the second point. Peter Wilson, this is one of many articles that relate to the multiplicity and interaction of risk factors that relate to the atherosclerotic process. These are Framingham data, 10-year coronary heart disease risk incidence for 55-year-old men and women, we're seeing that the impact of cigarette smoking just takes you up another notch in terms of risk. Of course, men all the way along have more risk than women, but cigarettes clearly keep you on the straight line no matter which gender you are. Now, here's some data that really continues to maybe surprise some of us. I mean, in the 50s, tobacco and cardiovascular disease was well known in terms of a relationship. And just like obesity, which is kind of now starting to be a major concern about cardiovascular disease risk, is really at the forefront, it's taken 50 years to reduce smoking prevalence from over 40% now down to 24% for at least white and African Americans. We still have much too much smoking. 25% of Americans still smoke. And globally, we think it's increasing around the world, a bigger concern perhaps. And as you can see, there's a racial dependency. And if you're Asian American, you're female, only 11% of you smoke. They're perhaps the brightest among the various ethnic groups that I have up there in terms of this decision not to smoke. But here's a bigger concern. These are children, grades 9 through 12, and we're seeing for white girls and boys about almost a 25% prevalence of tobacco use. And that's less for blacks and a bit higher for Hispanics. And the data are alarming in that each day almost 4,000 children take their first trick at a cigarette, and then ultimately 1,500 of these kids will become regular smokers. That's really an alarming figure. So this is an area of much concern. And I think in terms of the impact of smoke, we know it begins in utero, progresses through infancy. During childhood, we relate smoking to asthma and otitis and cognitive problems. And ultimately, the addictive behavior probably begins somewhere in adolescence. And ultimately, as an adult, we have all the concerns that you're dealing with here at the Methodist Hospital, and we deal with in Denver, and everybody deals with around the world. So this concept of tobacco and risk doesn't simply begin in adulthood, but begins early in life in terms of the impact in mothers who are exposed to low birth weights and a higher incidence of stillbirth. Now, mechanisms for tobacco and atherosclerosis, we could go on the rest of the hour and talk about this. In general, the concept is oxidative stress. And when you have a lot of oxidative stress, you affect the vascular wall, you enhance the thrombotic tendency through platelet aggregation and decreased fibrinolysis. You increase lipid peroxidation, adhesion molecules, and enhance the smooth muscle cell proliferation that Peter Libby talked about in the movie. So we got all these negative downstream effects and clearly more atherosclerosis. Kind of the good news is when you quit smoking, that risk goes down to about the level of never smoking within about a year of cessation of tobacco use. That's good news. So your risk is the same as it was before you quit smoking if, in fact, you have left the habit behind. So what do we do as clinicians? First of all, we have to ask about tobacco use every visit. It's an important point. We ignore this in the clinic often, but it's really relevant. We need to advise every tobacco user to quit smoking. And I always begin there. I run a lipid clinic at the University of Colorado, and in the lipid clinic, my first question related to modification of risk relates to smoking. So that's something all physicians, whether you're an orthopedic surgeon or you're a plastic surgeon, needs to ask about their patients. Assess the tobacco user's willingness to stop smoking and assist by counseling and developing a plan for quitting. Your hospital, I'm sure, has a program that hopefully is successful. You've got to arrange for follow-ups and referral to special programs and consider in some patients pharmacotherapy. And then finally, urge avoidance of exposure to environmental tobacco smoke at work and home. And you can get active politically in this process if you want. My former chairman, Bob Schreier, spent a lot of time getting tobacco legislation before the legislature in the state of Colorado. Unsuccessful, unfortunately, but he spent a lot of time doing this and made an imprint on the state of Colorado. Now, why is the level of evidence B in class one only? And I think it's important occasionally to refer to what these levels of evidence really means. So level B evidence is limited, meaning only 2 to 3 populations have been really extensively evaluated. And class one evidence for a level B is limited evidence from single randomized trials or non-randomized studies. And I think the reason the evidence is B1 is the fact that we're not going to see randomized studies where we have people continuing to smoke versus those who stop smoking. It's not like a drug trial, right, where we're looking at drug X versus placebo. We're looking at an event-related habit that ultimately we have sufficient evidence that results in disease. And just to compare it to level A, multiple 3 to 5 population risk strata that have been evaluated, and the general consistency of direction and magnitude effect is there. And finally, we've got multiple randomized trials that give a level A class one indication. So it's good to remind yourself of kind of evidence-based medicine. The environment we exist in today is what accrues sufficient evidence to get the labels that are put on various risk factors. I'm not going to spend time here today, but for cardiovascular disease, it's fasting lipids for every person 18 and older and every 5 years subsequently if everything's normal. Blood pressure routinely measured, weight and fasting glucose are kinds of things we think about in terms of routine assessment of cardiovascular disease risk. Now let's go to nutrition.
So, excuse me,
yep. Well, that's a changing paradigm, isn't it? When I went to medical school, I remember a total cholesterol above 300 was considered abnormal because that's where the 95th percentile was, right? Well, you know, today it's at 175, and now with increasing evidence with people with heart disease that LDLs of 70 are beneficial, who knows? Maybe a total cholesterol of under 125 is where the normal range is going to be. I mean, I saw a patient at the lipid clinic on Tuesday who's got bad coronary disease, a very low HDL, and has a chronic stable anginal pattern, and his LDL cholesterol maximally treated is now 32, and I didn't modify his treatment because of his ongoing disease. He's had 40 catheterizations and 14 PCIs. in terms of stents and or other modifications, atherectomy. So what's a normal LDL? I don't know. It's a moving target. But the evidence right now says if you have disease and continued risk, you should be under 70.
So what, at what level do you treat? Is it age-dependent? Is it absolute? What do you do in your clinic when somebody comes in and you screen him or her?
Well, I turn to the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel 3 guidelines, and they indicate four levels of LDL, 160, 130, 100, and 70. People with zero or one risk factor can have LDLs above under 160. 130 is two or more risk factors. Use the Framingham risk equation and then determine whether the risk is intermediate, i.e. 10 to 20%. If it is, you have an option for more aggressive treatment. And people with existing coronary heart disease are people who are considered to be coronary heart disease equivalents. That's carotid disease, abdominal aortic aneurysm, or diabetes. Interestingly enough, diabetes is considered a coronary heart disease equivalent. The goal is 100. And under 70 remains an option for people with known disease who have continued risk, such as a smoker or people with a metabolic syndrome or other a multiplicity of risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Did I answer your question? So I use the NCP guidelines as my goal, and everybody in my chart has an LDL goal determined at the first visit that we sustainably acknowledge and treat to at subsequent visits.
But an 18-year-old with no risk factors, would still be 160?
That's correct. Yeah, and that may be too high. I mean, we may look back someday and say, this is ridiculous, 160. We should, you know, ratchet these things down another 30. But that's a moving target. And again, right now there's more evidence if you have heart disease to get you under 70 than there was to get you under 100 in 2001 when the last set of guidelines were written. I might just say that I'm on my way to NHLBI at the end of November for a meeting that involves 17 other people who are both pediatricians, internists, cardiologists, and epidemiologists and beyond. You will not see an adult treatment panel for guidelines. The guidelines are now going to be converted to global risk guidelines that relate to all of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So we're going to be able to use the current Framingham score and magnify it appropriately for other populations and have a new algorithm in terms of how to approach cardiovascular disease risk. So that's a theory at this point, but the reality is NHLBI has made a decision not to, in fact, pursue additional ATP guidelines. I think the current cholesterol guidelines are probably going to stick, and they may actually be more conservative in terms of LDL lowering. All right, let's go ahead now. Let me point out, first of all, that foods are not good and bad. Foods are foods. They're there to enjoy. And so you don't have to confess a piece of birthday cake and some ice cream at your kid's birthday party. That's ridiculous. Let's think about the overall diet. And if we look at the most recent guidelines that the American Heart Association published last year, here are the take-home messages. Overall, eat a balanced diet with plenty of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, non-fat, low-fat dairy, legumes, poultry, lean meat, and fish. Maintain a healthy body weight by matching caloric intake to energy expenditure. Thirdly, maintain a desirable lipoprotein profile. That's what we were just talking about. The nutritional aspects of that is limited amounts of saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, and using unsaturated oils and fish as substitutes for higher saturated and trans fat intakes. And finally, maintain a normal blood pressure in some people by limiting salt and alcohol. And the recent evidence is that unequivocally fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy have a beneficial effect that goes beyond the salt content of the diet. The DASH diet, so you will, referred to in the literature, is a diet that ultimately is sometimes limiting in salt and sometimes not limiting in salt that contains these constituents and has been shown to have an independent benefit on lowering blood pressure. So these are the kinds of food items that ultimately should be encouraged in a normal diet. Now, one thing that always comes up in nutrition is kind of where the FDA stands on nutrition. And I think this slide's just worthwhile for a minute or two just to recognize this issue, because this is an unfortunate issue in some ways, but fortunate in many other ways. The American Heart Association runs a heart check program. You've seen that in the grocery stores where you see that little check and has the HA symbol on it. Well, those are foods that meet the following criteria. For total fat, 3 grams or less, sats, 1 gram or less, trans fat, a half gram or less, cholesterol, 20 milligrams or less, sodium, 480 or less, and the jelly bean rule is applied. You know what the jelly bean rule is? jelly bean rules, meaning you can have all of these be at the goal level for FDA approval, but you got to have more nutrients than simply sugar. Okay, so the jelly bean rules got to be more nutrients than simply one macronutrient content. And over here for whole grain, these are the FDA certified food products, less than 6.5 grams of fat for a whole grain serving. Servings about the size of your fist. A gram of saturated fats or less, half gram of trans, 20 of cholesterol, 40 for sodium. The jelly bean rule applies. 51% of the reference amount customarily consumed by weight should be whole grain, and 1.7 of fiber, and up to 3 grams of fiber of a 55-gram serving. So this is based on 30 and 55 grams, respectively. Now, what do you see as a problem here? I mean, these are good, I think, in terms of foods that would be potentially heart healthy. Well, the problem is here in the saturated or the total fat content. I mean, fish has plenty of fat, but it's omega-3s, right? It's not saturated fat. It's not trans fat. It's omega-3s. So unfortunately, fish doesn't get approved as an FDA-certified food for use in terms of prevention of cardiovascular disease or, quote, heart-healthy or cancer-healthy foods. So that's an issue. What's taken the FDA so long, I'm not quite sure. But the FDA has other problems, too, that we need to be thinking about. One of my favorite studies, and I want to preface this by saying this, that nutrition science is largely observational. Now, we can pick a series of biomarkers and bring people into a clinical research center, and we're going to modify their diet for a period of time, 6 weeks, 3 months, and look at the impact on biomarkers, insulin sensitivity, anything else we want to measure. We can see change based on changes in dietary macronutrient composition, or in some circumstances, even micronutrient composition. But when we're looking at outcomes like heart disease and stroke and total mortality, we're looking at observational analyses. In other words, what's happening to people who have certain dietary patterns. I think this study is one I like to show is because it's a study looking at the detection of breast cancer. So this was a study carried out in 42,000 women, 5.5-year follow-up, total number of deaths, 2,000, enough to really analyze. And the food quality was assessed baseline by the recommended food score. What's that look like? Well, the recommended food score is the sum of the number of foods recommended by the current dietary guidelines. And those are USDA guidelines. But just by the way, the USDA guidelines are very consistent with those of the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, and the American Dietetic Association. There's not major differences between all these guidelines. So we're looking now at fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, lean meats, poultry, consumed at least once a week, and the maximum capable score using this metric is 23. Let's look at the data. Now, this is all-cause mortality. Remember, this is the Breast Cancer Detection Project. But now we're looking at all-cause mortality. Here are women with the least favorable RFS quartile, and here are the women with the best. And I think you can see very clearly that all-cause mortality relates very strongly to how, quote, high quality your nutritional pattern is. Secondly, this is a fun slide for me to talk to because these are adjusted by every biomarker you can think of adjusting data for to looking at outcomes. And what it shows is that the women who ate a higher quality diet still had a highly significant benefit in terms of all-cause mortality. So what do we conclude from that? I think what we conclude is that we can measure everything we know how to measure, but there's something about eating well that we don't understand in terms of how it benefits outcome. I mean, that's the simple, very unsatisfactory conclusion of when you adjust for everything we know how to measure, we still can't explain totally what a good diet looks like. And if we turn to cardiovascular disease per se, it's a little weaker in terms of the p-value, but that trend is still there. Again, adjusted for all the other biomarkers, cholesterol, smoking, HDL, everything we know how to consider ourselves with in terms of risk for cardiovascular disease, the nutrition pattern still shows benefit that goes beyond anything we measure. Another study, and I'm just showing you a couple of examples of the observational data that are out there. Remember, these aren't interventions. These are dietary patterns that relate to outcomes. The Harvard Nurses Health Study has been frequently published, and you see it typically in journals like the New England Journal and JAMA. So what Meyer Stamfer and the group at the Harvard School of Public Health did is they assessed these nutrients in the diet of women who were former nurses in the Harvard Nursing School. trans fat intake in the fifth quintile, meaning the best quintile in terms of nutrition patterns, was less than 1.5% of total energy. The polyunsaturated or saturated ratio was greater than 0.4. That means relatively more vegetable oils and less saturated fat. The cereal fiber was 4.2 grams per day or greater than that. The glycemic load, which is how much glucose rise you get after eating a pure glucose load, and it's estimated for a variety of foods, was less than 723. The N-3 or fish consumption pattern was greater than 0.1% of total energy, and the folate level was greater than 525. You might argue with some of these items that have been listed here, but overall these were considered by the group at the Harvard School of Public Health as ones that they felt were representing the healthiest nutritional pattern. So what we're looking at here is relative risk for the least quintile all the way to the best, and you see this very impressive inverse relationship as we just showed for the Breast Cancer Detection Project. But what we see down here is the merging of quintiles 4 and 5 and then bringing a few other aspects into the analysis. Non-smoking, exercise more than 30 minutes a day, a body mass index under 25, and a modest amount of alcohol intake was associated with a substantial reduction in coronary heart disease incidence in this population of women. So, you know, although observational, it's hard to argue with these kinds of outcomes in terms of what a healthy lifestyle really looks like. Now, one of the studies that frequently gets mentioned that did not show a benefit in terms of a dietary modification was the Women's Health Initiative. And in that study, there was a randomization of women to their continued intake of total fat and a group that ate less fat, by design, 20% of total calories. This study showed no convincing benefit of modifying total fat consumption in terms of cardiovascular disease risk. Let's look a little more closely here at this study. Was the WHI study of dietary fat restriction and CVD prevention really worth it? A lot of tax dollars here. I mean, this study had a lot of different outcomes that were analyzed, but this was clearly one of the important ones. Number one, the outcome was pre-selected as a secondary outcome, not a primary. But, of course, you could criticize my showing the Breast Cancer Detection Project because that was not the primary outcome of that. It was breast cancer detection. All right, so we'll accept a secondary outcome. Secondly, inadequately powered. Yes, that is a statistical concern. But more important, the intervention was unsuccessful. The focus at the time this study was designed in the 80s was percent fat. But is percent fat important? Who said that? Yeah. Well, you were engaging me before. I thought this was just Well, no, I think that the percent fat may be important, but this study clearly didn't show that the women ate as few fat calories as they were supposed to. But nevertheless, it's probably saturated fat and trans fat we should be concerned about. I mean, total fat, if it's vegetable oils, probably doesn't do too much to risk. And we'll come back to that in a second. And fruits and vegetables and whole grains, the goals for consumption of those foods wasn't there. They didn't meet that goal. So the study wasn't adequately implemented and probably had the wrong dependent variable in terms of modification of total fat, not saturated fat. And there were no other lifestyle interventions. These women had to maintain stable weight and physical activity levels. Those were not interventions that were part of the study design. So in a sense, this study really does raise some concern. The final is the age of the women that were part of the study, 50 to 79. And that's not saying maybe it's too late to do some things, but maybe the dietary patterns established in the teenage years or 20s might be beneficial long term. But anyway, total fat, I'm not sure, again, is the right variable to really think about modifying. Now, Walter Willett's been concerned a long time about the AHA's dietary guidelines, concerned about the USDA's guidelines. And so Walter's made a big impact here. And he kind of runs the Harvard School of Public Health studies that relate to nutrition and outcomes. So Walter says we ought to rebuild the food pyramid. And in fact, he's contributed a major way to rebuilding it. We're not quite sure yet that rebuilding's going to be solidly in place in terms of benefit. But let's think about what Walter would like Americans to be eating. He's turning to this Mediterranean diet concept of abundance of plant foods, minimally processed foods, locally grown, fresh fruit as a typical dessert with limited simple sugars, cheese and yogurt daily, limited amounts, fish and poultry, low, moderate amounts of consumption, 0 to 4 eggs per week, red meat in low amounts, wine daily with meals, and finally, olive oil is the principal source of fat. Now, Walter's a friend and a colleague, and I respect him tremendously. But in fact, here's the ultimate, let me go back just a second, the ultimate difference between and a Mediterranean diet and what's recommended by the USDA and the HA and the ADAs really is simply the higher quantity of olive oil. All of these components really are very consistent with the other dietary guidelines. So there's nothing really unique about these recommendations here. This is the major difference. Now, monkeys are not humans, but Larry Riddell, a colleague and friend at Wake Forest University, has carried out some very special studies. And they're special because of the outcomes. They kind of surprise you. He's taken monkeys and given them diets of three types of fats for years, like a decade plus, and then examined their arteries at the time that they were sacrificed. One group of monkeys got diets that were higher in saturated fat. Another group got diets that were higher in monounsaturates or olive oil. And the third group got high in polys. Now, everything you'd expect about these diets on biomarkers really occurred. Saturated fats fed monkeys had higher LDL. They had higher HDL. The polyunsaturates had lower HDL and lower LDL, and the monos had, quote, beneficially, lower LDL and higher HDL. So the biomarkers all look favorable on the mono diet in terms of HDL and LDL. And you know what the outcome was? The monkeys had got as much monounsaturates, meaning things like olive oil, as they did saturated fats, had as much atherosclerosis. And if you look at the fatty acid that's in the artery, it's largely oleic acid. So it's a monounsaturated fat. Now, that doesn't make the population data in the Mediterranean wrong. I mean, that's observational data in a population that does consume a bit more olive oil. But should olive oil be a staple in the diet? I think it's a little premature to really think in that manner. Now, the other thing Walter's been concerned about, and the HA's really agreed with him very much so here, is the whole issue of trans fat. And here I'd like to give you a little evidence of what the American Heart's been doing in this area, something I've been personally involved with.
Is trying to educate people about dangerous fats.
The American Heart Association ratcheting up its campaign against trans fat.
The latest weapon in the battle, a website
that includes a special calculator. It's called My Fat Translator.
And I'll check out that website as well, something a good site for a lot of people out there.
Face the Fats is the new American Heart Association campaign starring the Bad Fats brothers, Trans and Sat.
Nothing like a nice thick steak and a loaded potato.
Tempting goats and flaky pastries.
A lighthearted approach to helping prevent the number one killer in America. The American Heart Association website is also chock full of information.
The American Heart Association has, in fact, launched a campaign called Face the Fats.
Health Connect reporter Diana Gonzalez shows us how we can face the fats.
We've all been warning to watch out for partially hydrogenated oils, but replacing margarine with butter can also be bad for the heart.
When we substitute saturated fats for trans fats, we ultimately...
Enough of that, but it goes on actually and shows Alton Brown, and he and I appeared together on 30 consecutive broadcasts. We'd operated out of his studio in Atlanta, and the point of those message bulletins was the fact that, you know, taking trans fat and taking it out and labeling your foods as trans fat free and substituting saturated fat is not better for your health. And so the idea that people are misled of thinking zero trans fat or trans fat free, they got to examine food labels to see what else is in the food. There's a restaurant in Denver. I heard the advertisement the other morning for the first time called the Big Fat Burger. And this is probably 35 or 40 grams of saturated fat, but it's labeled as no trans fat. So don't be misled. Don't have your patients being misled about the substitution of saturated fats for trans fats as being an acceptable alternative. This article is entitled Dietary Recommendations for the Prevention and Treatment of Coronary Heart Disease. Do we have the ideal diet yet? And raises the concept of nutrigenomics. What's the concept of nutrigenomics? The idea is we all have a genetic basis for our nutrient response. And ultimately, we may be able to target individualistic dietary recommendations based on your genetic profile. This is kind of like pharmacogenomics, but now applied to nutrition. So these might be ways to promote health, disease prevention, or disease intervention. And scientifically and economically, this seems feasible, but it's clearly it needs to be tested, and we're probably a decade or two away from this. Now, here's an example of nutrigenomics. When you feed people polyunsaturates or vegetable oils, their HDL typically goes down, and that's shown in the next slide. So if we look at this is the HDL response ultimately to feeding polyunsaturated fats. HDL, actually this is total HDL ratio, but HDL tends to go down. But ultimately these fats differ in terms of their ability to raise LDL. Now let's go back here and look at this again. This is a promoter mutation at the minus 75th base pair of the promoter of the APOA1 gene. And what these data have shown from Ernie Schaefer's lab, if you have the standard genetic profile, when you feed polyunsaturated fats, there's a fall in HDL when these polyunsaturates are increased from less than 4% of total calories up to greater than 8%. But an adenine for guanine substitution makes you, in fact, increase your HDL level as you ingest more polyunsaturated fats in the diet. So I'm using this simply as exemplary of the fact that our genetic sequences of genes that relate to lipid and lipoprotein metabolism and perhaps blood pressure and many other things really may in fact be the future of medicine, trying to identify who's going to respond and what type of diet they should be on. Now, through Walter's influence in addition to others, the USDA dietary guidelines have in fact become somewhat individualistic. The idea here is a one-size-doesn't-fit-all, and this My Pyramid plan can help you choose the foods and the amounts that are right for you. And you can quickly access this and decide what might be the best dietary recommendation. But notice this isn't only nutrition, it's physical activity. Let's now turn to physical activity. We know that being physically active relates to coronary heart disease prevention, and the mechanisms are multiple, including the anti-atherosclerotic effects, the anti-ischemic effects, the anti-thrombotic effects, and the anti-arrhythmic effects. Now, a paper by John Myers really was a stellar one a few years ago. There's a multiplicity of literature here. So what he looked at is people with known cardiovascular disease in the white bars and people who were without cardiovascular disease in the dark bars, looking at relative risk of all-cause mortality related to quintiles of exercise capacity. Observational and very interesting that the more fit you are, the greater capacity you have, the less outcome that relates to cardiovascular disease. Then what John did is broke it down based on history of hypertension, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes, largely type 2, tobacco use, obesity, and a total cholesterol greater than 220. And what he found was a staircase relationship between exercise capacity with the greatest capacity at the blue level down here, put at 1, and lesser capacity from left to right. And in all conditions, underlying conditions that relate to chronic disease models, many of which predict an increased risk for cardiovascular disease, we see a benefit. Now, for women, those studies by Myers were done in men. The studies in women are embarrassingly few, and that Myers is just a tip of an iceberg effect that I'm showing you here. But in women, we've got a total of 30 articles that I was able to survey from the literature. And there appeared from these articles to be a dose-response relationship between levels of physical activity, heart disease, stroke, and overall CVD. But these studies in terms of sample size were low, and the benefit fairly consistent, but I think we clearly need more evidence for studies in women. Now, the American College of Sports Medicine and the American Heart have joined together to write guidelines for exercise, and these are what they look like. These are just published very recently. Moderate intensity aerobic exercise is recommended at the level of 30 minutes 5 days a week, or intensive aerobic exercise for more than 20 minutes 3 days a week. So if you're not doing one of these, you can do the other. They both are evidence-based in terms of reduction of risk of cardiovascular disease. And now, for the first time, resistance training has been added. They feel that the evidence is sufficient to say doing a little bit of weightlifting or doing other things that enhance performance related to muscular strength is indicated. And the recommendation is more than 2 days per week, two or more days per week. Now, I'm going to close with the whole area of obesity, and because that really is an area where prevention would be nice. Because I think, and this is part of my science, what I do, I think when people get heavy and expand their body fat, that fat is defended. And I think partly they defend it because once upon a time we didn't have to, you know, do anything but find our next meal. And so you had to be physically active to get it. And obesity really was a tremendous advantage when, in fact, food deprivation was present. I wrote a book on obesity about 5 years ago. In the first chapter, I did the best I could of surveying all the data that was from World War I, World War II, the IRA starvation experience, looking at how fatness preserved life without food. And I was able to substantiate that point very well. The heavier you were when food wasn't available, the longer you lived. The IRA is probably the best example. These guys went to jail and died in jail from starvation. And the heavier they were going in, the longer they lived. So that's a frightful literature to have to look at. But it makes a point that obesity was good for you if we lived to 40. But today we live to 80, right? And obesity is no longer good for you. And here's the projected data for the whole world. This is just not a USA problem, but it occurs in developing worlds, countries around the world. Now, one of the big concerns for obesity is when other risk factors accompany it. And this is the metabolic syndrome, which deals with expanded waist circumferences, high triglycerides, low HDL, high blood pressure, and glycemia, initially defined at 110, but now at 100 milligrams per deciliter. And if you look at some 37 studies where 43 cohorts have been examined, when you control for other risk factors for cardiovascular disease events, you find the relative risk of the metabolic syndrome, which is largely driven by obesity, about 50% above what it would be without any other risk factors. Again, controlled or adjusted for other risk factors. Now, the metabolic syndrome is perfectly defined for weight reduction because waist circumference obviously comes down when you lose weight. Triglycerides come down when you lose weight. Now, when you're losing weight, your HDL comes down while you're losing weight. But after you've lost the weight, the HDL is higher than it was before you lost the weight. Blood pressure comes down with weight loss, and glucose comes down with weight loss. And not part of the definition is high levels of C-reactive protein, IL-6, other inflammatory markers. They also fall with weight reduction. It doesn't take a lot of weight reduction either to modify risk. 5% for blood pressure, 5 to 10 for glucose intolerance, 10% for lipids, and even modest amounts for chronic obstructive sleep apnea and left ventricular dysfunction. So to lose weight, you got to eat less than you burn. It's very simple. And I think if you look at a data-based importance of how lifestyle as a whole enters into risk reduction, we can look at the diabetes prevention program of 522 men and women in Finland, BMI 31, randomized to control or a healthy lifestyle, including less total fat, less saturated fat, more fiber, more exercise. Mean follow-up 3.2 years and about a 60% reduction in new-onset type 2 diabetes by that lifestyle intervention. And then the diabetes prevention program in the States, over 3,000 men and women, a bit heavier, age range wide, randomized placebo, lifestyle with a goal weight reduction of 7%, and metformin was a third arm at 850 BID. The study was prematurely halted at 3 years because of this benefit, with a reduction, again, by about 55 to 60% in new-onset type 2 diabetes. Now, if we go back a slide, I want you to see that you can lose weight, but you don't keep it off very well. So over the period, the weight started coming back on, but the benefit was still there. And the amount of weight reduction was the most powerful predictor of benefit in terms of new-onset type 2 diabetes. Now, remember, the lifestyle intervention in both the Finnish study and the diabetes prevention program was low diet and exercise. Let me look at it, some data from Steve Blair's Cooper Clinic experience, which looked at 19,000 men aged 20 to 79. The subjects' baseline were divided into low, moderate, and high-risk groups based on the Adult Treatment Panel 3 guidelines for cholesterol. The first group had their LDL at goal, and they basically were healthier. The second group had a therapeutic lifestyle change based on their baseline evaluation. This group was about one-sixth of the total group. And the third was at higher risk because they needed medication to modify risk at baseline. And fitness was assessed by VO2 max, and cardiovascular disease mortality was examined over 10.2 years. No surprise, those people that needed medication to modify cardiovascular disease risk had a higher relative risk of CVD mortality. Here's the group that needed lifestyle interventions, and this group, in fact, was pretty healthy at baseline. But here are the interesting data. Fitness benefited all three groups. So the people that needed pharmaceuticals to modify risk had about a 60% reduction in risk. The group with therapeutic lifestyles to modify risk had about an 80% reduction and relative risk. And the group that was even healthy to begin with, ultimately fitness at baseline predicted benefit. So what I've tried to do is conceptualize a healthy diet and its potential impact on outcome, and now physical activity and physical fitness and how it relates to the outcome. Back to diet. Which diet's best? The study at Tufts said it doesn't make any difference. You lose weight quickly on the low-carb diet, but at a year, the weights are really no different. So it probably doesn't make any difference how you lose the weight. It's just eating less and keeping it off. American Heart put out a book called The No-Fad Diet. I like it because it gets around all these kind of crazy ideas that the grapefruit diet or the cabbage diet or something else is going to be more beneficial. This is an evidence-based text written in terms of nutrition, physical activity, and behavior modification. I recommend it. It's now in paperback. It's in its second printing. Profits go to research, so there's no moneymaker here. How long does the weight loss last? Well, this is just one example. Only 6% of all people losing weight kept it off at a level of 5% or higher for 6 and then 15 years later. Weight comes back. So you can't just lose it for a while. It's going to come back. So ultimately, this is something we have to recognize as clinicians. Jim Hill, Rena Wing have looked at those things that relate to people who have successfully lost weight and kept it off for a long time. Avoid frying foods, substituting, interestingly enough, low fat for high fat. Don't confuse that with the Women's Health Initiative study. Leisure time, number of strenuous activities per week and number of sweat episodes per week, predicted benefit. And finally, the restraint scale. You got to be concerned about weight regain. You get on the scale a lot, you're concerned when you see the scale go up and you modify your behavior in terms of outcome. Now, Look Ahead is going to be the first study that's ever intentionally looking at outcome related to weight reduction. This population is a very structured population. This is an 11.5-year outcome study looking at intensive weight loss in obese subjects with type 2 diabetes. Now, in my opinion, type 2 diabetes may not be routine obesity without diabetes, but they picked a group that had a higher risk for cardiovascular disease development so that it could be powered for an outcome at 11.5 years. 5,000 men and women, ages 45 to 74, BMIs above 25, primary outcome, time to a major cardiovascular disease event, and many, many secondary outcomes. Here are the one-year data. These were just published in Diabetes Care. Weight loss, 8.6% in the intensive lifestyle group, 0.7% in the control group. Waist circumference down 6.2 centimeters in the intervention group, minus 0.5 in the control. Triglycerides down 30 milligrams per deciliter versus 15. HDLs up 3.4 versus 1.4. Systolic blood pressure down 6.8 versus 2.8. Fasting plasma glucose, these are diabetics, remember, down 22 versus 7. And metabolic syndrome prevalence down 50% simply by losing 8% of their body weight. All right, now here for obesity, it's just like smoking, the big problems in children. You know, our kids are bigger today, and that's really a concern down the road 30 and 40 years in terms of their risk for cardiovascular disease. And this is maybe the first generation where children will die before their parents. I mean, that's kind of a frightening statement, and I'm not sure how much truth is going to be born out there, but it's something we need to pay attention to. And over the last two decades, the rates in children and adolescents has tripled. Now, when I was at the HA, I had the privilege of getting to know President Clinton and Governor Huckabee reasonably well through the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. This was an alliance formed by the HA with the Clinton Foundation to try to modify four types of things that relate to childhood obesity. The first was industry, and you may remember about a year and a half ago, the American Beverage Association changed the beverages in schools around the country. That was really the action of the alliance. And it was hard for me to believe, but 90% of the vending machines in schools that handle beverages are controlled by the American Beverage Association. That's both public schools and private schools. The school system has been affected by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Some 54 schools have been identified where interventions are taking place in terms of nutrition and physical activity. The kids is represented by the Nickelodeon commitment to $30 million of free advertising directed to kids directly about their risk for weight and heart disease. And finally, the healthcare, which I think is probably the toughest thing of them all, to try to modify reimbursement patterns to physicians who take care of obesity or try to prevent it in their offices. And what's a healthy lifestyle do for you? I'm going to show you Jack LaLanne. I like Rick Riley's column. I kind of read Sports Illustrated on the plane as a downer after spending all my time in science and medicine. But Rick had this article a couple years ago about Jack LaLanne. At 89, Jack's got a 46-inch chest, a 31-inch waist, does 100 push-ups without turning as much as light pink. And here's his diet. Protein soy drink for breakfast. I'm not pushing soy. Okay. Lunch, 4 egg whites, 5 pieces of fruit. His dinner's a salad with 10 raw vegetables, brown rice, grilled fish, and, of course, a glass of wine. So, in conclusion, so that's what a healthy lifestyle does for you. No guarantees here, and it's probably your gene profile that might, maybe is going to modify that one way or perhaps even the other. But lifestyle's important. I think the evidence for smoking cessation is probably not as good as we'd like, but we don't have to really think about more studies being needed here to tell people not to smoke. Screen for early detection of disease. Unless you know you got risk, you're not going to be able to modify it as early. So screening is important, whether it be cancer, diabetes, or cardiovascular disease. Thirdly, diet is important. If you need to lose weight, you need to eat less. And by the way, losing weight is not exercise. Losing weight is eating less. Keeping it off, now exercise becomes much more important. And I didn't show you the literature today. I could have gone on for hours about that literature. But losing is calories in. Keeping it off is calories out in terms of maintenance strategies. And finally, physical activity I just alluded to in terms of obesity, but even if you're lean, being fit seems to have a solid benefit in terms of outcomes. So I want to thank you all for your attention. It's late in the day, and I appreciate it. Thanks.